Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff. On the NewsHour tonight, a slow response. A top official admits law enforcement should have acted more quickly during the school shooting in Uvalde, Texas, questioning why children were left barricaded in a classroom with the shooter for nearly an hour. Then the pandemic's fallout. A look into how COVID and anti-Asian sentiment have hurt businesses in Chinatown neighborhoods in New York and across the country.
Sometimes I see people coming into our restaurant yelling slurs and just giving us trouble. And, you know, I see my dad trying to be strong, but I worry about him.
And it's Friday. David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart discuss the tragedy in Uvalde and what Georgia's primary election results say about former President Trump's influence in the GOP. All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. Today was supposed to be the first day of summer break for students in Uvalde, Texas. Instead, the community is still reeling from the shooting that left 19 children and two school teachers dead. Days after the attack, there are more questions than answers. But we are learning new details about the law enforcement response and the terror inside classrooms at Robb Elementary School. Amna Nawaz is in Uvalde tonight. Amna, first, tell us what you have learned.
Judy, here in Uvalde, the more we learn, the worse it gets. Officials today laid out the most in-depth timeline to date of what exactly happened during Tuesday's shooting, detailing the 78 minutes that passed before authorities finally confronted the gunman, even as children trapped inside the classroom called 911, begging for help.
3 days after the deadly rampage that left 19 of Uvalde's youngest dead, grief and anger commingle in this tightly knit community.
I will never have my baby again. And they need to do something about it. They need to not forget us, the babies, the kids.
Javier Cazares' daughter, Jacqueline, was killed on Tuesday. He was outside the school during the shooting in disbelief over the police response.
They were there without proper equipment. I saw their 15, 20 minutes later, they came with their shields. Like, that should have been in their cars, you know, going in, not waiting 30, 45 minutes to get in.
Vincent Salazar's 11-year-old daughter, Layla, was one of the victims.
How fast can you act? I mean, I don't know. I don't know how much of a difference it would have made. You know, if, you know, maybe they could have acted faster. It remains to be seen.
Today, the director of the Texas Department of Public Safety, Stephen McGraw, offered the most detailed timeline to date. Just before 11:30 a.m., the gunman crashes his truck near the school. A teacher calls 911, and the gunman begins shooting inside school windows. At 11:33, the gunman enters the school through a door officials say was propped open by a teacher and begins shooting into two classrooms. At 11:35, Uvalde police officers enter via the same door and take fire from the gunman. Multiple rounds are fired for the next several minutes. More officers continue to arrive, and by 12:03, there are 19 officers in the hallway outside the locked classrooms. Beginning at 12:03, a student from inside the classroom begins calling 911. Officials say she whispers as she talks and makes several calls. She shares how many are dead, how many are alive, and that the gunman shot at the door. During one call, more than 30 minutes after her first, she begs, please send the police now.
They breached the door using keys that they're able to get from the janitor because both doors were locked. Both of the classrooms that he shot into were locked when officers arrived. They killed the suspect.
It's still not clear if the 19 officers in the hallway knew at the time there were children alive inside the classroom.
The on-scene commander considered a barricaded subject and that there was time and there were no more children at risk. Obviously, you know, based upon the information we have, there were children in that classroom that were at risk, and it was, in fact, still an active shooter situation. And for the benefit of hindsight, where I'm sitting now, of course it was not the right decision. It was the wrong decision, period.
The news here in downtown Uvalde was met with frustration, anger, and confusion.
What happened? An hour's worth of time that nobody went in? What happened? I don't know what happened, but I know one thing. My husband is a retired firefighter. And when 911 happened, firefighters were running in. They were going up. They weren't coming down. And they knew that when they were going up, they wouldn't be coming back down. What happened? Why did it take so long for them to get in?
As a parent, I think I would have been rushed in there without thinking twice. I don't care if they would have tased me or taken me down. I think I would have done whatever I needed to do to try and get my children out of that school. And I'm still really confused about that, why they waited so long to get in there.
Later this afternoon, Texas Governor Greg Abbott had this response.
I was misled. I am livid about what happened. My expectation is that the law enforcement leaders that are leading the investigations, which includes the Texas Rangers and the FBI, they get to the bottom of every fact with absolute certainty. There are people who deserve answers the most, and those are the families whose lives have been destroyed. They need answers that are accurate, and it is inexcusable that they may have suffered from any inaccurate information.
Uvalde's collective grief has manifested here, a makeshift memorial in the town square. Hearts heavy and arms full, their offerings now piled high at the foot of each cross. Flowers at the base and stuffed animals for these youngest victims. Tess Mata was 10 years old, a fourth grader at Robb Elementary School. Some of her soccer teammates came together last evening to lay flowers, scribble notes, and just remember their friend.
You know, Judy, for days now, as the community has mourned, the question has loomed, could more have been done to possibly save some of those lives of the 19 children and two teachers? With today's revelations and the massive failures, it's now clear were made in the immediate response. The answer is a heartbreaking yes. Judy.
Amna, it's just impossible to imagine what these families, these parents of these children who were inside the school are thinking or feeling right now. I know you've been talking to several of them. What are they telling you?
Judy, the parents who lost children are now left to wonder, what if? What if police had acted sooner? What if more had been done? Would my child be alive today? They are now busy staying with each other, mourning, making funeral preparations. And we can also now share that an El Paso funeral home, more than 7 hours away, has offered to donate and truck in caskets for those youngest victims, because Uvalde will need so many more of those smaller caskets. But I should mention, I spoke with the mother of one student who survived the shooting. That is 11-year-old Mia Cedillo. She survived in her classroom. She mentioned to her mother after she got out that her teacher had been shot, her friends had been shot. Her mother says she dipped her hands in their blood and smeared it on herself too, and laid still so the gunman would not know that she was alive. Her mother also says Mia was one of those students who was calling 911 and asking for help. Her mother says Mia could hear the police officers in the hallway outside her classroom and didn't understand why they weren't coming inside to help her then. And her mother is very angry. She says she doesn't know why the people that they tell their children to trust and to call for help didn't do so. She believes if police had acted sooner, that more children would be alive today, like her daughter, Judy.
It's just impossible to comprehend this. So Amna, as you talk to them, where does all this frustration, this anger that they're feeling go? Are they telling you now what they want to see happen?
Certainly, as we reported, there will be some level of accountability. There will be investigations into the police response at the state, possibly the federal level as well. But parents here know nothing's going to bring back their children. And Uvalde now, like so many communities racked by this kind of violence, has been forever changed, right? But this does raise many questions, Judy. We're hearing here about exactly how much more can be done to protect students, how much more can be done to harden schools when you have this kind of a situation. The gunman in this case with two assault rifles, and officials revealed today over 1,600 rounds of ammunition. You know, the steps that were put into place here, that have been put in place at schools across the country, just did not work. There was no police officer on site. The door was not locked. And when the police arrived, they didn't do what they were trained to do. They did not confront and eventually neutralize that gunman until many of those children were dead. And so we're left with this bigger question, because this is now what children are trained to do, right? It's been striking to see over the last 3 days just how much of that safety burden has shifted to children in this situation. All children in America go through lockdown drills. My kids, many of our viewers' kids, since the age of 4 or 5, they know their hiding place. They know they have to go and stay quiet. And when you talk to the kids here, that's exactly what they did. Even though the adults didn't do what they were trained to do, the kids did. I talked to a third grader yesterday, an 8-year-old, who told me even though he was in the cafeteria during lunch when the shooting happened, he knew he had to run and hide, and he did exactly that, even though he wasn't in his classroom where he'd run through those drills. And I asked him, how did you know to do that? Did a teacher tell you? Did an officer tell you? And he said, no one told me. I just knew that I had to. Judy.
Just the heartbreak, the anger. Again, it's just incomprehensible. Amna, thank you very much.
Thanks, Judy.
Meantime, veterans of law enforcement are weighing in now on the controversial actions taken by those police officers during the shooting. William Brangham has more on that.
That's right. I mean, as we just heard from Amna, those officials are being harshly criticized for not acting sooner to confront the shooter and to potentially save some of those children, actions that they now admit were wrong. To help us better understand what police should and shouldn't do in these awful circumstances, I'm joined by Fred Fletcher. He's the retired police chief of Chattanooga, Tennessee, and he also spent many years as a police commander in Austin, Texas. Fred Fletcher, thanks for being here tonight. You've heard the timeline that investigators have laid out. 19 armed police officers are in the school outside the rooms where that shooter is locked in two rooms with some young students. And there is this punishingly long wait before they go through that door and confront him. I mean, as a former police chief, as someone who has trained a lot of police officers, what is your reaction to this?
I feel a great deal of grief, and my heart breaks for Uvalde. And when I think of those 29 minutes in particular that lapsed between the officers stacking up outside that door, shots being fired, and them finally breaching the door, that grief is compounded with a great deal of anger and some shame that we as a community have allowed this violence to continue on our children.
I mean, the officials today said that the local commander on the scene felt that this was a barricade situation where the shooter was simply holed up on his own and that there wasn't a threat to others, rather than an active shooter situation where there was a threat. What do you make of that distinction that they are making?
I agree with Director McCraw. It was the wrong decision, period, and there's no excuse for that. I can't say it better than Director McCraw did, that an active shooter has demonstrated they have no intention other than taking lives. And we know, certainly since Columbine in the late 90s, that active shooters are only going to stop when we intervene and we stop them.
I mean, I know.
As first responders, go ahead, William.
No, please, Fred, continue.
I was just going to say, we have an obligation to have a bias towards action. Police officers regularly run towards gunfire, and we train an active shooter preparation to engage, to draw the attention, emotion, energy, and fire from the shooter so that we put ourselves between violence and the neighbors we're sworn to protect. We have to have a bias towards action, and those decisions need to be left to the men and women who are on the scene, who have the information, not to a commander who is off the scene and receiving delayed information.
I mean, one of the most haunting aspects of this horrendous circumstance is that we know that while those officers are outside the room, that there are children inside that room calling 911 saying, we can hear the police out there. Could you please tell them to come in? I mean, that seems that there's a tremendous breakdown in communication, that was not relayed to those officers outside that room.
Uh,
clearly there are many questions about communication and passing of information. That's why we need to train, empower, and trust the officers who are on the scene of the violence to make the decisions to protect our neighbors, that they need to know that they are empowered and they are supported in intervening and engaging and taking that bias towards action so that they can engage a shooter, a violent perpetrator, and keep them from harming our neighbors.
You said that that should be the bias in all of police training. Is that what police officers are trained? If you go through active shooter training, is this a nationally understood issue that in those cases, you don't wait for backup, you don't wait for the SWAT team, that you have to act? Is that what they're taught?
Absolutely. We're literally taught and we teach that whether there's one or 100 of you, you move to the sound of gunfire and you place yourself between violence and the innocents. That's our job. That's our fundamental obligation. It's the way we train and it's the way we deploy.
And what if there are circumstances where we understand that there were a lot of wounded children in there. We also understand that police were trying to evacuate, or at least that's what they were telling parents that were being restrained outside, that there was evacuations going on as well. How are police supposed to prioritize those in the midst of these circumstances?
Not an uncommon situation, William. Again, the bias is towards engaging the threat. You stop the threat because you have a perpetrator who has demonstrated a desire to kill as many people as possible. So the number one priority is always engaging the threat, intervening and eliminating the threat. Often you're able to do multiple things at once if you have enough resources. You can evacuate, you can stage, you can treat simultaneously. But in any active situation, a bias, an intent, a priority has to be given to finding, engaging, and eliminating that active violent threat to our neighbors.
As you well know, as a former police chief, we are a nation that is awash in these high-powered, lightweight, very, very dangerous semi-automatic rifles. Officers in that hallway had to know what they were up against. And this is not to try to excuse anything about their actions, but do you think that that concern, that they may be up against weaponry that is perhaps even more powerful than what many of them were themselves carrying, do you think that that factored into this as well?
I think that if police officers are going to be deterred and intimidated by violent perpetrators carrying weapons of war, then we as a community should commit ourselves to doing something so that people can't kill our children with these weapons of war. I'm ashamed that we as a community, that our elected officials have sat on the sideline as children from Sandy Hook to today in Uvalde are killed by these weapons of war when we know there are common sense reforms supported by a majority of Americans that can have an impact on the availability of these weapons to kill our children.
All right, that is former police chief Fred Fletcher. Thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
In the day's other news, a congressional panel asked five major gun makers for data on assault-style weapons used in mass shootings. In a letter, Democrat Carolyn Maloney, who's chair of the U.S. House Oversight Committee, said gun manufacturers continue to profit from the sale of weapons of war. She called for information on manufacturing, marketing, and sales. The National Rifle Association opened its national convention in Houston today in the shadow of the killings in Uvalde and Buffalo. Former President Trump headlined the event. He rejected criticism of the gun lobby and of Republicans and called instead for a sweeping overhaul of school security and of mental health policies.
We need to drastically change our approach to mental health. There are always so many warning signs. Almost all of these disfigured minds share the same profile.
Several hundred protesters rallied outside the convention site, and several Texas lawmakers canceled plans to speak. Republican Governor Greg Abbott opted to send a recorded message. Russia's assault on eastern Ukraine slowly gained more ground today. Pro-Russian rebels said they have captured a railway hub in the Donbas region, and two key cities face round-the-clock bombardment. Ukraine's foreign minister said that his country is outgunned in a video he posted online.
The only position where Russia is better than us, it's the amount of heavy weapons they have. Without artillery, without multiple launch rocket systems, we won't be able to push them back.
Ukrainian officials say shipments of Western arms have been delayed and that the Russians are using the time to step up their offensive. President Biden told U.S. Naval Academy graduates today that they will have to defend democracy against the likes of Russia and China. The president addressed the Academy's commencement in Annapolis, Maryland, and warned that Russia is trying to erase Ukraine's national identity.
Attacking schools, nurseries, hospitals, museums, with no other purpose than eliminate a culture. A direct assault on the fundamental tenets of rule-based international order. That's what you're graduating into.
Mr. Biden also said the Navy must defend freedom of navigation in the South China Sea against China's increasingly aggressive claims in the region. New tensions are roiling the Persian Gulf after Iran seized two Greek tanker ships today. The Iranian Revolutionary Guard commandeered the ships. The Greek Foreign Ministry says helicopters landed on the vessels and that armed men took the crews captive. It followed the U.S. seizure of an oil from an Iranian flag tanker off Greece. Back in this country, U.S. Southern Baptist leaders have released a previously secret list of pastors and church workers accused of sexual abuse. The database includes more than 700 entries spanning the past two decades. The list first came to light in a scathing independent report last Sunday. It detailed how church leaders suppressed and mishandled abuse allegations. In Oregon, Democratic Congressman Kurt Schrader, who was backed by President Biden, has lost his primary bid. Schrader is a centrist who has served seven terms. He was ousted by Jamie McLeod Skinner in a big win for the party's left flank. A ballot printing issue had delayed the results for more than a week. And Wall Street has finally ended a seven-week skid, with tech stocks and retailers leading the way, and new data showing that inflation is moderating. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 575 points today to close at 33,213. The Nasdaq rose 390 points, 3%. The S&P 500 was up 2.5% for the week. All three indexes jumped well over 6%. The S&P had its best showing since November of 2020. Still to come on the NewsHour, how businesses in New York's Chinatown are coping with COVID and anti-Asian harassment. David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart discuss this week's political news. And we remember the children and teachers who lost their lives during the elementary school shooting in Uvalde, Texas.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington, and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
The pandemic threatened business districts across the country, but misguided fears and rhetoric about Asian Americans made things particularly hard for Chinatown neighborhoods. For this report, during Asian American and Pacific Islander Heritage Month, John Yang visited one of the nation's most well-known Chinatowns in New York City. It's part of our ongoing Race Matters series.
Dim sum carts stacked with bamboo steamer baskets, bustling kitchens, board games in the park. These days, Manhattan's Chinatown looks a lot like its pre-pandemic self.
It was very, very eerie during.
And walked through the heart of the neighborhood with cookbook author Grace Young, and the scars of the pandemic are evident.
This was a family-owned supermarket, and it closed during COVID. It had been there for years and years, and they just didn't have the business. As we come along, here is Lung Moon Bakery. This was the place to go for custard tarts, and their mooncakes were just out of this world.
What else is lost when a business like that disappears?
So it's not just about the wonderful food. It's about our memories. And so many people talk about the fact that they've been going to Lung Moon ever since they were a child. And I believe when you lose a place like Lung Moon, you lose a part of yourself.
Young, known as the Stir Fry Guru, grew up going to San Francisco's Chinatown with her father, a Chinese-American liquor salesman.
I grew up just loving that small town feeling about Chinatown, that feeling of belongingness and home.
But in the four decades she's lived in New York, Young says she had come to take this historic Lower Manhattan neighborhood for granted.
Because of my work, I would be in Chinatown once or twice a week, shopping for groceries, eating food, but I never introduced myself. I came and went and did my own thing.
That all changed in early 2020 with the pandemic.
Because of misinformation and xenophobia, people stopped coming to Chinatown.
Young started sharing the struggles of mom-and-pop businesses on Instagram and Facebook and helped create two social media campaigns, hashtag Save Chinese Restaurants and hashtag Love AAPI. She launched a video project with a Korean-American videographer, Dan Ahn, for the New York Museum Poster House, telling the stories of Chinatown shop and restaurant owners.
Business has dipped down even worse, and I can say that I'm down pretty much from 50 to 70%.
It is time to take more dramatic measures.
Hours after Young conducted those interviews, then New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio announced a citywide lockdown, bringing business to a virtual standstill. By 2021, a survey found that more than half of Asian-owned businesses in New York State reported that their revenue had dropped more than 75%.
Oh, but that's this time it takes really long for really serious damage for our business.
Dennis Chung was born in what was then called Saigon, and since 1995, he's owned Pasteur Grill and Noodles, a Vietnamese restaurant that's one of the many legacy Chinatown businesses that isn't Chinese. The downturn in business during the pandemic has put them behind on their rent, and today he's facing another challenge.
Look like the business back to the normal, but you don't forget one thing. Everything inflation right now, the price, everything is go up right now.
This was his American dream, and COVID turned it into a nightmare.
Chung's son, Tony, is getting his master's degree in biomedical science this summer and is applying to med school. Watching his dad struggle during the pandemic, he wanted to help, offering ideas about the decor and the menu and applying for federal aid.
A lot of these businesses are owned by people who don't speak a word of English except maybe they know how to say some food items on their menu. So, you know, it's close to impossible for them to apply for PVP and all these government grants.
And on top of everything else, the Chungs, along with other residents and business owners, have had to deal with increased anti-Asian harassment.
Sometimes I see people coming into our restaurant yelling slurs and just giving us trouble, and you know, I see my dad trying to be strong, but I worry about him deep down.
The history of American Chinatowns is rooted in racism, as Chinese immigrants arrived in the mid-1800s to mine gold and build railroads. Cookbook author Grace Young.
The Americans wanted cheap labor, but even as they wanted cheap labor, they did not want the Chinese to live among Americans. So the Chinese were segregated to live in their own ghettos. And that's how Chinatowns formed.
Just as some made Asian Americans scapegoats in the early days of COVID, in the 19th century, they were unfairly blamed for smallpox outbreaks in some cities. Stanford University historian Gordon Chang.
The Chinese became targeted as a population that was not just undesirable in taste or in preference, but as biologically dangerous, and thus should be eliminated and moved out of the core of the city, lock, stock, and barrel, and moved into some corner or kept out of the country entirely.
In recent decades, historic Chinatowns have faced new challenges like gentrification and an aging population. Vic Lee sees it in New York's Chinatown, where she lives.
The authenticity that is here comes from the residents, many of which are low income.
And for them to be this integral part of the community, but also be unable to stay, this is what's really at risk for the authenticity of Chinatown and what it's going to look like.
For Lee's late grandmother, Tai Mui Chang, who couldn't read or speak English, Chinatown was her piece of America.
I have such fond memories of, you know, scooping rice into the rice bowls, carrying it back to the dinner table, and once she sat, we would all like bend our elbows and eat. And I have a tattoo where it's 135, which stands for her apartment building.
During the pandemic, Lee co-founded the nonprofit Welcome to Chinatown, which has given almost $600,000 to small businesses.
We are focused on uplifting our community's entrepreneurs because we know that they're what grounds this community.
Are you optimistic about the future of Chinatown?
I'm cautiously optimistic. There's still a lot more that needs to be done in this community, but where I am optimistic is seeing how much people care. And I'm really excited about that.
Cookbook author Grace Young, recently recognized by both the James Beard and Julia Child Foundations for her work supporting Chinatowns, is still worried by what she sees on the streets of Chinatown.
How do you feel when you see empty storefronts?
It completely terrifies me. And I feel that we have to do everything in our power to save and protect Chinatown. Everyone has to do our part, and history will thank us for that.
For Young, her part is raising awareness across the country on social media, but it's also doing what she can for businesses in her own Chinatown. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm John Yang in New York.
Any meaningful changes to federal gun regulations appear unlikely, even after the unspeakable tragedy in Uvalde, Texas. And as the mass shooting unfolded on Tuesday, voters were casting their ballots in primary elections in Georgia and several other states. To discuss what this means for the November midterm elections and for the country as a whole, we turn to the analysis of Brooks and Capehart. That is New York Times columnist David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart, associate editor for The Washington Post. Hello to both of you. Welcome to the program after another very tough week in this country that we love. Jonathan, the news we're hearing today about the slow police response is adding to the heartache of this awful event in Texas. But at this point, how are you processing all this?
Slowly, painfully, I have to say. The overriding emotion is I'm tired. I'm tired of watching grieving families pour their hearts out about losing their young children. I'm tired of politicians who don't move to do anything to even pass something that won't stop every mass shooting, but at least might prevent one or two, or we don't know. It's almost 10 years since we saw 20 children slaughtered at Newtown, something we had never seen before in this country. And here we are 10 years later, looking at yet another mass shooting in a school, 19 children killed. What is it going to take to get folks in Washington, to get folks in state houses to protect our children? I'm tired of politicians who go on and on and on about being pro-life and for the unborn, but have seemingly no care for them once they are born. What is it going to take?
How are you dealing
with this? Well, some of the news stories are unreadable for me, you know, especially the interviews with the surviving kids from that school. And I guess, aside from the sadness of it, the frustration that Jonathan just expressed, I wonder what it's like for all of us to experience the news these days. And it's not only been this 2 weeks, it's, I'd say, since 2013. It's been pummeling to experience the news and to be in the news business. And that can't not have an effect on us all. Just the emotional blows, the moral blows, and then the haunting fear that these events are not isolated incidents, but part of a rising tide of menace across society. Not only the mass shootings, racist, against, crazy against children, but just a growing level of sense of people are under threat. And it could come from violent crime. It could be even trivial things. I talked to a guy, a nice guy who owns a restaurant. He says he has to kick somebody out every week now for rude and brutal behavior. School board meetings, churches, co-op board meetings, just a rising tide of menace. Peggy Noonan, columnist for the Wall Street Journal, said people are proud of their bitterness now. And so I worry about the whole moral atmosphere of this country, of which these mass shootings are only the most cancerous effects.
And we all know this shooting in Texas happened, Jonathan, 10 days after we had a shooting in a grocery store in Buffalo, New York. 10 people mowed down, all of them black.
Right.
And this followed other mass shootings. There have been dozens. Looking at you, you talked about what are we going to do about it? What are we going to do about it? We look to Washington, we look to our leaders, and what do we see?
Well, we see inaction. We see them doing nothing. I interviewed Senator Chris Murphy on my MSNBC show the Sunday after Buffalo, just two Sundays ago. And I asked him, what can you do? You were there during Newtown and nothing happened. Not even a background checks bill could get through. Overwhelmingly popular with the American people. Several gun safety measures are overwhelmingly popular with the American people, and yet Congress can't do anything about it. And he said to me, he always has to be hopeful, but he's skeptical, and that maybe the only thing they can do is just bring bills to the floor and have people vote and have them be on record. And I'm adding this, standing against the safety of children, grocery store shoppers, parishioners, movie theater goers. It's heartening that Senator Joe Manchin, who was a part of that way back when, 10 years ago, the Manchin-Toomey bill, background checks didn't go anywhere, but now says, I think about my grandchildren. And that's nice, good, think about your grandchildren, but you know what? I don't have children. And my heart still, if I wish I were a member of Congress, I wish I was in a position to cast a vote that would make it possible to do something about this. But, Americans will have an opportunity in November. If they are tired of seeing what's happening, then they can do something by voting with their feet and voting, going to the ballot box, and putting people in office who will do something to protect us. Because I agree with you, there is an atmosphere of menace in this country. I feel it. As an LGBT person, I feel it as a black person. And at a certain point, it's just gonna be, I'm gonna feel under siege just as an American, period. And that's no way to live.
And you do have, David, I mean, large swaths of this country believe that guns are a right. They point to the Second Amendment. Today, just moments ago, former President Trump, speaking at the NRA convention in Texas, is talking about we need to focus on mental health, that nothing, no new gun law could have prevented what happened in Uvalde.
Yeah, I mean, their argument is that A, it's a right guaranteed in the Constitution. B, they have an ethos of we take care of ourselves and that we're going to provide our own safety. And C, they have an ethos that the government's out to threat and the gun rights are a way to prevent threat from the government. And finally, it's become a culture war issue where the gun has now become a mythic emblem of rural life, and a lot of the people who support gun rights say it's just a bunch of coastal elites telling us how to live our lives. I think there may be some hope. I'm a little more hopeful for two reasons. One, every time one of these events does happen, it does change minds. And if you look at the history, even from all the way through all these shootings, you see a spike in support for gun regulations, which then drops over time, but doesn't drop all the way back. And so gradually you see, and then I think there is the possibility of changing the way we talk about this in order to get people who are winnable. And that's not to phrase it as gun control, we're going to take away your guns. That's to phrase it as gun regulation. Like, we have driving regulation. Mm-hmm. We have cars, and we regulate the cars. And there are all sorts of things you could do that are kind of like what we do with cars. Like, we could raise the age limit at which you buy a gun. It's 18, this kid was 18, you could raise it to 21, that would make a difference. Background checks, the red flag laws. If you see somebody in your orbit who is suicidal or something, you can go to a law enforcement and make it impossible for them to get guns. There are a whole series of things. Somebody made the point, I think it was my colleague Nick Kristof, that if I lose my phone and you pick it up, it's basically useless to you because you don't have my code. Why can't guns be like that? And so there's a whole series of things that can be done that are just normal because we do them for cars. Yeah. But we have to somehow stop this from being the culture war issue, because then it's just hopeless.
But my sense, Jonathan, is that even moderate Republicans, many of them are resistant to doing even these modest steps.
Right. I'm sorry, Judy.
No, that David just outlined.
Right, and I have no explanation for it. I seriously don't understand. What about a 48-hour waiting period, or for someone 18 years old, parental consent? They're willing to put those restrictions on young women who are seeking reproductive care. Why not do the same thing for anybody wanting to buy an assault rifle, an AR-15, a weapon of war? I don't understand. How many more babies are going to have to be killed, slaughtered in classrooms before Congress does something, before moderate Republicans come out and say, this is not what we're for, before NRA members, who we keep hearing, vast majority of them are very nuanced, they understand what's going on, and yet their leadership is doing something completely different. I would love it for somebody at the NRA convention happening right now as we're speaking, were to rise up and say, this is not who we are, but that's not going to happen.
But you think something could happen. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I mean, there are majorities, and I do think public opinion, like as you say, public opinion is overwhelmingly in one direction. I just have to hope that something can be done.
We have to have hope. We have to have hope. We mentioned former President Trump. In many ways, he was not on the ballot, but his choices were on the ballot, Jonathan, in some more of these primary races this week. And we saw several of the people he endorsed not win. Now, there's still some out there running who very much have the Trump imprimatur. But what is this? Does this say that maybe there's a weakening of his influence? What do you see?
I think it depends on the state. It depends on the jurisdiction. I mean, David Perdue got stomped by more than 50 points by Brian Kemp, someone who Trump was desperate to knock out. Didn't happen. Brad Raffensperger, another person, survived the challenge. But, you know, you can look back at J.D. Vance, who Trump swooped in at the last minute and put him over, or Mastriano in Pennsylvania. To me, the bigger issue is not which Trump-endorsed candidate wins and which one loses, how many. To me, it's how far is the person who wasn't endorsed by Trump, policy-wise, how far is that person away from Trump? And to me, Trumpism, with Trump or without Trump, is here. And so, great, Brad Raffensperger beat out the Trump-endorsed candidate, but I don't think there's a whole lot of daylight between Trump and Raffensperger on anything else that goes, you know, beyond the big lie. To me, is the big concerning issue.
Excuse me. Is there much distance?
No. I mean, Trump was Trump because in 2016, the Republican elite was over here, and the Republican voters were over here. And Trump somehow noticed this and said, I'll be over here. Thank you very much. The Republican elite is now over here. And this is what normally happens in American history, that you get a third-party candidate or some new force, and then one of the parties co-opts it, and that's sort of what's happened. And so I think that makes Trump actually weaker, because now there are Trumpists everywhere, and so he doesn't have the one unique lane that he had in 2016. I also do think it's a sign in Georgia when you get the governor, lieutenant governor, and the secretary of state, all Republicans, all standing up to Trump together with a lot of the other Republicans in the state of Georgia, it shows that if you combine together to stand up Trump, you can beat him. And I think it also shows that January 6th, this was really about January 6th more than all the other primaries. And it could be a sign that the big lie is not a winner, just not something Republicans want to go to the mat for anymore.
Could be. A number of them are maybe changing their mind, but a number of them are saying, I don't want to talk about it, but neither are they saying that there weren't any problems in 2020.
Right, and that's a problem, that's an issue. And as I've said before, I'm hard pressed to tell you what any of these Republicans running for office, what they're for,
beyond their position on the big lie, whether they're for it or against it. And when it comes to Mastriano, the gubernatorial candidate in Pennsylvania, if he wins, the big lie is going to be front and center come 2024 because he, as governor, appoints a secretary of state. And we have then we would have a major electoral state that could mess up a peaceful transfer of power.
No matter what, we're going to end, as David said, on a hopeful note. We're going to do that, well, no matter what.
Wrap it out of the hat.
David Brooks, Jonathan Capehart, thank you both.
Thank you.
As we've been reporting, 21 people died in Uvalde, Texas this week in the shooting at Robb Elementary. We want to take a moment now to remember those 19 children and two teachers, the lives they led, and the legacies they leave behind.
10-year-old Xavier Lopez was an honor roll student who never shied away from a camera. His mother, Felicia, told reporters he could not wait to start middle school. "That smile I will never forget," she said. "It would always cheer anyone up." 48-year-old Irma Garcia was a fourth grade teacher at Robb Elementary, where she taught for 23 years. She had previously won the school's Teacher of the Year award. Her husband of 24 years, Joe, died of a heart attack just 2 days after the shooting. Their nephew, John, told reporters, "I'm really in shock right now." 9-year-old Eliana Garcia was outgoing and loved to sing. Her aunt, Syria, a middle school teacher in Uvalde, spoke about her niece.
"She was very happy and very outgoing. Loved to dance and sing and play sports. She was big into family and enjoyed being with the family."
McKenna Lee Elrod was a natural leader and loved tumbling. Her aunt Allison said, "Words cannot express the pain my sister and our family are going through. I know in the coming weeks, my sister is going to be overcome with so much." McKenna was 10 years old. Amory Jo Garza loved being a big sister and had just gotten a phone for her 10th birthday. Her family said she was killed trying to call 911. Her father wrote on Facebook, "I would do anything to have you back. Visit me in my dreams anytime." Cousins 10-year-old Annabelle Rodriguez and 9-year-old Jacqueline Cazares were in the same class at Robb Elementary. Their aunt Polly posted to Facebook, "My beautiful angels, at least you are together. Our hearts are broken in a million pieces. We love you." Fourth grade teacher Eva Morales, 44, had an expertise in special education. One parent said she will never forget how Eva went above and beyond for her daughter, Gabby, who has Down syndrome.
"It was more than anybody else has ever poured into my child, and I've just never seen anyone quite so dedicated."
The family of 10-year-old Eliana Cruz Torres waited for hours for information about her whereabouts. She was to play her final softball game of the season, the day she died. Her aunt, Leandra, told reporters that Eliana had mixed emotions about the day. She didn't want softball to end. Fourth grader Tess Mata loved Ariana Grande and the Houston Astros. Her big sister, Faith, wrote on Facebook, "I'm angry because a coward took you from us. Sissy, I miss you so much. I just want to hold you and tell you how pretty you are." Tess was 10 years old. 8-year-old Uzia Garcia liked playing football and video games. His grandfather told reporters, "He was the sweetest little boy I had ever known. I'm not just saying that because he was my grandkid." 11-year-old Layla Salazar was fast, winning first place in several races at the school's field day. Her brother Nicholas spoke to reporters about his sister.
"We're just glad that we gave her the best life we could while she was here. There was never a dull day with her."
cousins, Jace Luvanos and Jaylaw Nicole Silguero, both 10, were the babies of their family and had just mourned the loss of their grandfather. Their grandmother, Linda, said she told her daughter, just look at it as your daddy taking your baby with him. Hours before the shooting, Alexandria Rubio made the honor roll. Her mother wrote on Facebook that the 10-year-old also received the Good Citizen Award. We told her we loved her and would pick her up after school. We had no idea this was goodbye. 10-year-old Jose Flores had also just received an award for making honor roll. His uncle, Christopher, told reporters Jose loved going to school. He was very smart. Alethea Ramirez was a kind and caring soul. When her good friend was killed in a car accident, the 10-year-old continued to send artwork to his family. Her friend's mother told reporters that shows how pure and kind her heart was. Navea Bravo, also 10, could put a smile on anyone's face, according to her cousin. The family waited for hours to find out what happened to her. Her cousin told reporters, we thought she was missing. It just feels like a nightmare we can't wake up from. Maita Rodriguez was 10 years old. Her family said she dreamed of going to Texas A&M to become a marine biologist. A family member wrote on Facebook, her mom wants everyone to know that her baby girl had a dream. Rogelio Torres, 10, was known as a very smart and loving child. His mother, Eva Dulia, remembered her son.
He was a loving person. That's all I can say. He loved us. He was the one that made me, all my kids make me happy, smile and everything, but I lost him.
And friends and family of 11-year-old Miranda Mathis remembers her as fun and spunky. Her older cousin, Deanna, wrote on Facebook, my sweet baby cousin, we loved you dearly. I'm so sorry.
And our hearts go out to the loved ones, to the families of all these innocent people. We are crying on the inside here. And for more on the horrific events in Uvalde this week, join moderator Yamiche Alcindor and her panel on a special edition of Washington Week. That's tonight on PBS. And tune into PBS News Weekend tomorrow and Sunday for the latest from Texas. Also tonight here on PBS, you can watch the latest episode of this season's Beyond the Canvas, hosted by Amna Nawaz. The show features interviews and profiles with some of the brightest stars in music, art, and more. Tonight's episode is called Art Innovated. Here's a sneak preview.
On Beyond the Canvas, we speak with artists who are true innovators in their fields.
I want to tell the past in order to project something for the future.
That's the point of the Korean Vegan, bringing people together over some really delicious food.
It's not South Asian classical music. It's living in its own world.
The legacy that I want people to embrace is Black Man Majesty.
The latest episode of Beyond the Canvas premieres tonight at 10:30 p.m. on most PBS stations. Check your local listings. And that's the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Join us online and again here on Monday evening for all of us at the PBS NewsHour. Thank you. Hug your loved ones. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon.